From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. A local stalemate could be on the verge of a tipping point. So far, mediation has not worked between LAUSD and the teachers union trying to hammer out a labor deal. If 30,000 teachers go on strike, what happens to the district's 500,000 students? Plus, last week we heard from Marshall Tuck. Today, Tony Thurman on why he wants your vote for California's superintendent of public instruction. It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I mean, Martinez, it is already a very windy day. Trees are blowing around. Lots of stuff flying around on the roads right now. In fact, this morning when I got on the 134 in Burbank to head to Pasadena, right around Glendale Central Brand, two giant pieces of cardboard were frisbeeing their way in my direction. So luckily, there was no one around. I got to do some nimble driving to get out of that out of a possible disaster. So please, please, please keep your head on a swivel today and stay safe. All right, coming up in today's show, we look at the link between earthquake fault lines in Mexico and also here in Southern California. We also look at a system to help communities when disaster strikes. It's called social infrastructure.
It refers to the physical places that shape our interactions. And it's, in fact, just as real as the infrastructure for power or water or transit.
We speak with a sociologist about where residents can gather in times of trouble. First, though, the Santa Anas are kicking big time. That means an increased risk of wildfire here in Southern California. Last winter, high winds contributed to one of the worst wildfire seasons on record. And last night, PG&E in Northern California shut off power to some customers to safeguard against fires. SoCal Edison is now monitoring their coverage areas and will do the same if necessary, says Paul Grigo.
You know, the three sister utilities, so to speak, in California have been coordinating our actions and our protocols in terms of how we monitor and respond and proactively take steps.
Customers have already been notified in areas where the shutoffs might occur.
Given the dynamic nature of the situation that we're in, we're not going to probably have the opportunity to let them know hours in advance or even minutes in advance of us having to take action because it's that quick.
All right, now the areas of greatest concern are along the foothills in Santa Paula, Simi Valley, and Oxnard, as well as some parts of Orange County. SoCal Edison hopes the winds will die down and the need to shut off power will be over by tomorrow, but
the forecasts have been changing quite a bit over the past 48 hours, so I'm being careful here and making sure that we don't make promises that we won't be able to keep.
As a year-round fire season becomes the new normal in California, SoCal Edison will continue to update its policies and shutoffs, policies around shutoffs, Grigo says. All right, moving on to education now. A battle between LA Unified School District and United Teachers Los Angeles is reaching a tipping point. A strike could happen, in part because of continuing disagreements over a new teachers union labor contract. If 30,000 teachers do walk off the job, it would be the first LAUSD teacher strike since 1989. But there's still reason to hope that this won't happen. KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes is here to tell us what we need to know. Kyle, welcome.
It's good to be here.
All right. The union and district officials have been in mediation to try and come up with a deal. But on Friday, it was clear that that was not working. They've now moved into what's being called the fact-finding phase. So what is the fact-finding phase?
Yeah, fact-finding, it's sort of like mediation in that the two sides are sitting in a room with a neutral third party. But unlike mediation, what happens in fact-finding is that eventually this third party gets into the game. They don't just sit on the sidelines and try and, you know, force the two sides to make a deal. They actually weigh in and try and basically decide who they think is making better arguments about what should be in the contract. So, for instance, the two sides are far apart on issues like salary. The union wants the district to give them a 6% salary increase. The district wants to offer much less. So the fact finder comes in and they're going to, you know, in some cases hold something like a mini trial here, evidence hear from witnesses, hear oral arguments, closing arguments. Sometimes it's a little less formal than that, but that can happen during fact-finding. And ultimately, the fact-finder weighs all of this evidence and comes back with a formal opinion. Then they might say something like, well, we don't think the district can afford 6%, but maybe you could afford 5%. And the idea, this opinion becomes public, it's formally issued. The idea is that maybe the fact-finder's opinion can get one side or the other to make a concession or two, and that kind of gets the ball rolling towards a deal. Maybe. That's the hope.
Now, you mentioned salaries, the big sticking point in this dispute. Is that pretty much why mediation hasn't gone well? No one wants to budge?
Well, there's
or can budge?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of issues. Salaries are obviously a big one. I mentioned the union wants 6%. The district currently offering kind of a 3+3 deal right now. 6.5%, I should say, is what the union is looking for. The district is offering a 3% ongoing increase plus another 3% if the district's finances remain in decent shape. But there are a lot of other issues on which the two sides are pretty far apart, like class sizes, staffing levels for nurses, librarians, counselors, you know, regulations for magnet programs. But it's possible, A, that the biggest issue here is actually that the two sides' mistrust of each other has been dominating this process. And that's just judging from the rhetoric. I mean, the district, right after mediation was over, came out with a formal complaint against United Teachers Los Angeles, saying you guys showed up to the first day of mediation saying the whole process was pointless. And so they filed a formal complaint saying that the union was negotiating in bad faith. On the other hand, the union turned around and was like, you guys are the one who said we don't think that mediation is going to result in a deal. That's something that Superintendent Austin Buettner said in public on multiple occasions, that he didn't think that mediation would make a difference. So definitely a lot of bad blood, in addition to whatever differences on issues that we see, are sort of probably why mediation didn't work.
When it comes to labor negotiations, if both sides are pointing fingers, they're not putting the pen to paper.
Yeah.
Well,
I think this is important to note as well. Like, this is part of the brinksmanship for both sides. Both sides are trying to play up fears of a strike and use that to their advantage to leverage better terms. So, I keep saying, like, you know, trying to correct my own thinking about this, because it's like it does look really bad just judging from the public statements. But both sides, I think, are looking at the sort of fear of a strike as the biggest leverage that they have to make the deal that they want.
If this fact finding doesn't work, because it seems like a last ditch effort, if it fails, does that mean a strike is right around the corner?
Well, here's what happens. So the fact finder issues this report that I mentioned. They offer their opinions about what, you know, they think that the contract should look like. Now, that could be the blueprint of a deal, or the two sides can just ignore it and move on. It doesn't automatically mean after fact finding is over that the two sides go their separate ways. The two sides could go back to mediation if they felt that was a good next step. It's possible for them to go to binding arbitration, where you have a judge the fact finder is just sort of offering this in a non-binding way. Well, let's put it before an actual judge and have a judge decide. But there are the sort of nuclear options that become available after fact finding, and that's why this is important. I mean, it is kind of last ditch, because the district can just say that last, best, and final offer that we put on the table, that's now in effect. That's now your contract. And the union can respond to that by saying, all right, we're going to go on strike. So it is a little bit last ditch, eh? I mean, though there are other options if fact finding doesn't result in the blueprint of a deal, it is pretty close to the end here. So,
but is it a slippery slope? Fact finding is where you kind of can't crawl yourself back out of it, or is it just kind of, because I think people hear it and like, oh, great.
I know. I mean, it's hard to sort of dispel the fears. I was talking to a labor expert who sort of walked me through what the fact finding process is. And he said, you know, the mere fact that they had more than one mediation session is noteworthy. And so, you know, I mentioned this formal complaint that the district filed against the union for not really showing up to mediation.
Wait, noteworthy in a bad way?
Well, but they showed up. To mediation at all.
So that's good.
Which is a good sign, according to this labor expert. And also, I mean, fact-finding means there's still time for them to make a deal. So, I mean, I'm trying to inject just a little bit of hope into this process, because with labor negotiations, I've covered a teacher strike before. Everything looks bad until the very end. And at the very end, everything is all sunshine and smiles. So it's really not over till it's over.
Really quick, Kyle, if a strike happens, worst case scenario, what does it mean for kids, students?
The probable outcome is that buildings would remain open, but district officials say that it's very likely that attendance would go way, way down. So a little bit of a TBD on what kind of programming would be available. It probably would vary depending on your school, but certainly district officials expecting that attendance would go way, way down, even if buildings were to remain open, not staffed by teachers, but by administrators and aides.
Wow, lots of parents with jobs that rely on.
I know. Yeah. Make contingency plans, man.
KPCC education reporter Kyle Stokes. Kyle, thanks a lot.
You bet.
Turning now to the November 6th midterms, all election season as part of the KPCC voter game plan, we're looking at the top issues in SoCal congressional districts. We're hoping to help voters understand where the candidates stand so that they can make some smart decisions. And today, KPCC's Austin Cross takes you to District 25, which covers northern LA County and a part of Ventura County.
The latest polls show Republican incumbent Steve Knight almost neck and neck with Democratic challenger Katie Hill. And one issue could tip the scale for voters: taxes.
That is why we've proposed tax cuts that are pro-growth, pro-jobs, pro-worker, pro-family, and pro-American.
President Trump hailed his tax bill as a giant tax cut for the middle class and a boon for the economy. Lifelong Simi Valley resident Dean Lautman agrees.
Absolutely. This whole crumbs that I hear Nancy Pelosi talk about, but yet they're so eager to take it back.
But when I talked to 30-year Palmdale resident Andy Geist at a debate last month between Knight and Hill, he wasn't convinced.
You know, because I know where all the tax benefits are going. They're going to the wealthy. They keep saying trickle down, and we're down, and nothing's trickled to us yet.
Congressman Knight's vote helped push President Trump's tax plan out of the House. He says it's improved the economy, and that tax cuts mean a lot to people in the district.
We've seen it benefit for the last 6 months, and we keep getting better and better news about this. So the people that say this isn't a good economy, I don't know where they're living.
Yeah, I mean, we're not seeing that.
Challenger Katie Hill ran a nonprofit before getting into politics.
When you're putting us in a $1.5 to $2 trillion deficit to fund these tax cuts, then we should be making sure that they're making it to people who really need the help and who are, the backbone of this country.
Accurately measuring the full effect of Trump's tax plan can be tricky. So I brought in an expert. Ed McCaffrey teaches tax law at USC.
I mean, when I heard Congressman Knight say he wonders where the people are living who are not benefiting from this tax plan, I would say maybe in his own district.
McCaffrey says job and wage growth have risen at pretty much the same pace for the past 8 years, two of them under President Trump. Economists agree that the tax overhaul does get some credit for the country's booming economy, but wage growth hasn't kept up. Easier to spot, he says, are the negative ways the Trump tax plan could affect District 25. The cap on state and local tax deductions means many people could wind up paying more. The Franchise Tax Board estimates Californians will pay an extra $12 billion in taxes. And if those people leave California, the state might have to raise taxes for everyone else. Then there's the deficit that Katie Hill mentioned. The Congressional Budget Office estimates the tax overhaul could put the U.S. nearly $2 trillion deeper in debt.
And when you impact the deficit, the first effect you see is interest rates go up. And of course, that hurts the kind of people who don't have money but need to borrow money, which again are the kinds of people who live in the 25th district.
Most changes to the federal tax law were set to phase out by 2025. But on September 28th, just 1 week after I spoke with Congressman Knight, he helped the House pass a bill that would extend those changes indefinitely, setting the stage for cuts to Medicare and Social Security if the economy does not grow as projected. The Senate is not expected to debate it until after the election. But just what Congress will look like when it does is up to voters. I'm Austin Cross.
All right, so are you ready for Election Day? Get up to speed on what you need to know with KPCC's voter game plan. Read up on the candidates and ballot measures, find out about registration deadlines, and ask us your questions. Head on over to elections.laist.com. All right, we spend a lot of money on physical infrastructure to deal with natural disasters, things such as walls for sea level rise or rain-capturing basins for drought. However, an argument exists that makes a case for a very different kind of infrastructure. Coming up, find out why your local public library can be just as important. That's coming up when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Ian Martinez. Now to a moving story, literally about earthquakes. A new NASA study examined a set of links to faults between Southern California and Mexico. Those links could help researchers understand whether an earthquake in one part of the fault could splinter into more fault sections, resulting in a bigger quake. Scientist Andrea Donnellan of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory led the team on the almost decade-long study. She breaks down what these fault links can tell us about the potential for ground movement south of Los Angeles. Welcome to Take Two.
Hi.
Now, first of all, where exactly are these fault links?
So these fault links are at the border of California and Mexico, right at the border of Imperial and San Diego counties. So south of the Salton Sea and east of San Diego.
So technically we are still talking California.
We're still talking California. Okay. South of Anza Borrego for people that like to go hiking and see wildflowers.
And faults apparently right under their feet, yeah. And what drew you to this specific set of fault links? What makes them so important?
So what I'm interested in is how the Pacific North American plate boundary behaves and splits. Southern California is very complicated and the plate boundary is splitting. We also thought there was a high probability for an earthquake in that area, so we started blanketing the area with airborne radar measurements since 2009. And so at the time, we weren't allowed to radiate radar into Mexico, but we had very detailed measurements just north of the border in California. And then in 2010, in April, the El Mayor-Cucapá earthquake occurred, and we were able to track not just that earthquake, but all the motions and adjustments following the earthquake.
Do we know how this section of fault segments were first formed?
So the plate boundary is where the Pacific and North American plates are splitting apart. And so this piece of the plate boundary is still forming, which is why we have this kind of fracture mesh of faults in that area. But we have a pretty long continuous fault from the Gulf of California to Mexico, and then north of Ocotillo up to the LA Basin area, we have the Elsinore Fault. And this study shows that those two are actually linked.
Then I guess the question that I think most people would have is, how do these fault links clue us into the potential magnitude of an earthquake?
So the size of a fault section tells us something about the potential magnitude. One of the things we want to understand is how faults jump across steps and boundaries, how they connect. When does an earthquake grow into a large earthquake, and when does it stop at a small earthquake? One of the things we learned from this study, which I thought was very interesting, was not only were these two fault systems connected, but the earthquake occurred in Mexico, and then it continued to slip. I always say earthquakes break. They generate seismic waves, but the fault keeps moving. And what we add that's unique is we can measure that motion following the earthquake. And we showed that in the Ocotillo area, just south of the Elsinore Fault, the stress is actually dissipated. So we didn't load the Elsinore Fault. It may be loaded just from tectonic motions, but we didn't add additional loading to the fault from that 2010 El Mayor-Cucapá earthquake.
You said it slipped. What does that mean?
Literally slipped about 3 meters.
Literally? Okay.
So,
wow.
So about 10 feet of motion.
Wow.
So I liken this to your windshield. You're watching your windshield crack once a rock gets thrown into it. You kind of watch this crack propagate, and that's what we've been able to do over time.
We're talking about a set of links to faults between Southern California and Mexico with scientist Andrea Donnellan of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Okay, so now to gather data for the study, and you mentioned the airborne radar platform for NASA. In very simple terms, how does this radar work?
So the radar sends down a signal before and after an earthquake. So we do an image before an earthquake, bouncing radar waves off the ground. And what's useful about that is we can see through clouds. And then we do another pass after the earthquake, and we see how the distance between the aircraft and the ground changed as a result of the earthquake.
How accurate is this radar?
So we can see changes down to a centimeter, which is about a half an inch.
It's hard to understand that you could see something that tiny from that far away.
Yes, and so what's really interesting is geologists tend to go map earthquakes. After it happens, they map the ruptures, but this radar was able to send them to the tiniest of fractures that they did find on the ground, because we could see it from 41,000 feet.
Quite amazing. Now, what other data or technology is used to measure these ground shifts?
So we also use GPS, and everybody knows GPS now because
we
have it in our cars,
that.
We have
yeah.
it in our phones. We have different receivers that track more information from the GPS satellites, but those can measure millimeter level precision, so about an eighth of an inch. And from that, we get very continuous time series of how the ground moves and changes over time. So we fuse all these data together to get a good picture of how the faults are behaving.
So at the end of this, why is it so important to keep studying land movement after the ground stops shaking? Because I think most people think, well, it's over. That's good. That's it.
So when the earthquake happens, all the stresses in the area change, and the ground then adjusts. So I like to think of the Earth's crust as silly putty. You can pull it slowly, and it stretches. and we can measure that. You can pull it hard and it'll break. The seismometers measure that, and we measure that as well. So we add a more complete picture of all of the ground motions, all the adjustments of all these strains and stresses and the tectonic loading into one picture of what's happening.
Could this give us a clue as to, I don't know, future events like this?
This can help us assess hazard of earthquakes. So we can see where faults are active. Even if the fault is slipping very deep in the Earth's crust, we can detect that at the surface. So we can make an assessment of how active the fault is and what size rupture may happen based on the segments that are moving.
That's scientist Andrea Donnellan of NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. She led the study on a set of fault links between Southern California and Northern Mexico. Andrea, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
From understanding the threat of disaster to recovery now, cities up and down the coast are rethinking their physical infrastructure to protect themselves from potential disaster. Things like seawalls and homes built off the ground. But what about a city's social infrastructure, places where residents can gather in times of trouble? This is something sociologist Eric Kleinenberg has been thinking about. His new book is called Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Our Civic Life.
It's a new concept, but I think a very powerful one, and it refers to the physical places that shape our interactions. And it's, in fact, just as real as the infrastructure for power or water or transit, and we know it because when it's robust and well taken care of, we're much more likely to see people regularly, to build relationships and potentially even community. And when we allow it to fall apart and fail to invest in it, we're all the more likely to wind up alone, kind of hunkered down, atomized.
What kind of places are we talking about?
Well, there are all variety of places that are social infrastructures. The paradigmatic case is probably the neighborhood library, because the doors are open all the time and there's programming for people of all ages. You feel welcome there, really, no matter who you are, and you don't have to pay anything to be in a local library. But there's other kinds of social infrastructures that matter as well. After Hurricane Sandy hit New York City, I became the research director for an Obama administration project called the Rebuild by Design Competition. And it was a program that generated innovative infrastructure projects for the entire region. By pushing for social infrastructure, we could do things like transform a seawall that would protect water from being something flat and plain and simple and dumb into something rich. The wall expanded at the top and became a bridging berm, so that instead of just a simple barrier, you had a park, a bike path, a walking area. Here is hard infrastructure to protect us from a storm, but social infrastructure that makes life better every day as well.
So in other words, get more out of the seawall, because you call the seawall just simple and dumb.
A seawall is about the dumbest technology you could come up with.
Why?
Well, a wall is a wall, right? Mm-hmm. I'll be fair. You can have a seawall that's incredibly complex and complicated, gates that open and close to keep water from coming in. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, it's about trying to block one thing from happening. And it may or may not succeed. What we have seen time and again is that when the weather is very severe, the hard infrastructure fails. The water penetrates into the dry side of the land. The electrical grid goes out. Transit networks go down. And when the hard infrastructure fails, social infrastructure becomes all the more important, because it's what determines whether or not we're in touch with the people who are close to us, whether first responders, who are really our neighbors, can find us. And so if we have a notion like social infrastructure, we can build climate security systems that are much smarter and also much more powerful and effective and able to improve the quality of our lives every day.
So let me understand this. So when the weather gets to the point where it's so extreme that all of the things we have built to try and stop it fail, and now we're stuck just kind of relying on ourselves, this is where the social infrastructure comes in to build that sense of community.
Well, social infrastructure builds that sense of community only if it's there all the time. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the places that have healthy social infrastructure 365 days a year are also the places where people are likely to be best taken care of by their neighbors, even by their friends, when disaster strikes. But it's in those moments of emergency that you can really tell just what an impact social infrastructure matters. And that's something I discovered in the first book I wrote about a heat wave in Chicago where hundreds of people died in a couple of days. And the kind of remarkable thing I found is that even among very poor and vulnerable neighborhoods, those that had a depleted social infrastructure, you know, broken sidewalks, abandoned houses, empty lots, a lack of public activity, had the highest death rates in the city. But those very poor and vulnerable neighborhoods that had a robust social infrastructure wound up being even better protected than the most affluent places in the city.
And Eric, you don't think enough of this exists right now in the country?
Hardly. We are so far behind the rest of the world when it comes to developing social infrastructure. I have spent time doing research in places like Singapore, the Netherlands, which have made massive investments in physical infrastructure systems that protect you from the storm, but also promote quality of life all the time. And in the Netherlands, for instance, there are public plazas that are amphitheaters, parks, sitting areas, skating arenas, and they are fun places to be, and they help people connect and be outdoors almost every day of the year. And when a big storm comes, you put the walls up around them, and they convert into water storage facilities. In Singapore, they do similar things, but the water storage facilities do something that California could use. They trap the water, they store it, they divert it underground, and the water can get treated and then reused. So if you live in a place that's prone to drought, capturing water and managing it more intelligently is one of the most urgent challenges you can face. And it turns out you can do that while building social infrastructure too.
We're talking to Eric Kleinenberg. His new book is called Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. You mentioned how you've seen this in other parts of the world, and we don't have enough of it, in your opinion, here in the United States. You write about how efforts to revitalize the LA River itself is seen as a social infrastructure project. Can you explain that?
It certainly can be, because the LA River Revitalization Project can be a way to provide more and better access for communities in this city that currently have ecosystems that are too gray around them, that currently don't have parklands and good access to the healthiest and most pleasurable outdoor spaces. So river revitalization is one of these incredible opportunities to change infrastructure in a way that's not only good for the water, but it's good for people and communities as well.
Where else in the U.S. is this happening?
Well, one of my favorite examples is Columbus, Ohio, which doesn't get a lot of attention in the big national media, but turns out to have some incredible programs to support the library infrastructure. They've passed voter referenda to provide more taxpayer dollars for the library system so that the branch libraries can be updated, can have longer opening hours, and that means more people will be able to use them. You know, one problem that cities across the country face with the library is that it's now taking on so many different kinds of responsibilities because young people are using them in droves. Older people go there for companionship, immigrants, people trying to learn English as a second language, people with mental illnesses, homeless people, people with opioid addiction. They're all going to the library because it's a safe and welcoming environment. And yet the physical plant of the library is just outmatched. And it's incumbent upon cities now to update these systems. They're not luxuries. They're not obsolete. They're places that are doing so much vital social work. And if we don't repair them, if we don't invest in them, they won't work the way that they could.
How do we pay for all this, though? Considering, you know, as I mentioned, with all the issues that have us thinking about climate change and all the dangers that are going to spring up to this and all the money we're spending on this, how are we going to pay for that as well, for social infrastructure?
Well, we are inevitably going to spend tens of billions and eventually hundreds of billions of dollars on rebuilding infrastructure because, frankly, the infrastructure systems that we rely on in this country just to be part of the modern world are woefully out of date. In my view, if we understand what social infrastructure is, we generate a new menu of possibilities that allows us to build the hard systems we need to be part of the 21st century world, while also improving longevity, health, and dealing with all kinds of social problems here at the same time.
That's sociologist Eric Kleinenberg. His new book is called Palaces for the People: How Social Infrastructure Can Help Fight Inequality, Polarization, and the Decline of Civic Life. Eric, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A while back, we spoke to all four candidates vying for California Superintendent of Public Instruction. Now, that was before the June primary thinned out the race of the top two. Now, with November 6th just a few weeks away, we check back in with the pair of candidates that made the cut. Last week, we heard from Marshall Tuck. Today, Tony Thurman will tell you why he wants your vote for State Superintendent of Public Instruction. That's ahead when Take Two continues. Stay with us.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The midterm elections are just around the corner, and voters have a lot of decisions to make. Now, among them is selecting a new California Superintendent of Public Instruction. It's the highest office overseeing public education in the state, watching more than 1,000 school districts, and making sure the Department of Education follows California's laws. There are two candidates left, and last week we heard from Marshall Tuck, former president of Green Dot Charter Schools. Today, we hear from Tony Thurmond. He's an educator and a legislator representing the 15th Assembly District in the Bay Area. When we spoke recently, he talked about what he sees as the biggest challenge facing California's schools.
Well, you know, certainly funding. If you look at what California spends per pupil, California falls somewhere around 46 in the nation in per pupil spending. And that's been that way for many, many decades. And so we need to correct that and spend more on our kids. And it's not to say that it's just about money, but when you look at the places where we need more support, like special education and closing the achievement gap and closing our teacher shortage, resources matter.
What action can the superintendent take to address that specific issue?
You know, the superintendent has to work closely with the governor and the legislature to really generate more revenue for the state. You know, the superintendent, the position is different. It's part educator. It is part public official and politician. You've got to know how to move things in a system to get it to the hundreds of school districts in our state.
The campaign for the office of superintendent is often characterized as a fight between charters against unions. And clearly, you and your opponent don't agree on everything, but you two aren't that radically different when it comes to your views on charter schools. So why do you think the race has been reduced to this debate?
I think for a lot of people, that's just a quick soundbite, and it's easy to try and reduce it to a simple term as that, but it's much more complicated than that. I also think it's just an emotional issue, and because there is a significant number of charter schools that have opened in the last few years, it exacerbates the financial struggles that many of our existing schools currently experience. Now, here's the reality. As state superintendent, I will serve all of our students wherever they attend, a traditional public or charter public. These are all public schools. You know, for me, the issue of how we support schools in an era of charter growth is one of the issues that should be considered, but it is not the only issue. And I think we should continue to help voters see that there are a myriad of issues that we have to address to make sure all of our kids get a great education.
Where would you say you disagree with the teachers' union, and where do you see eye to eye with charters?
I would say this, that there have been some charters that have really been innovative. You know, I visited a charter school that serves Native American students, and Native American students have really been underserved in our state. And so to have a school that has a curriculum that respects the cultural needs of those students is a perfect example of where a charter school can really excel. The same is true for charter schools that have opened to support African American students who've really been disadvantaged and really experienced inequity in a greater way as it relates to the achievement gap. And so I'm proud to be supported by teachers, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to support everything that the teachers union asks for. Most recently, I voted for legislation that would change the start time of school for teenagers and preteens. For whatever reason, the teachers union didn't support it. I supported it because the data is overwhelmingly clear that a later start time is better for our older students.
Would you take this issue up again? Because that issue is dead for now. So I'm wondering, as superintendent, would you raise this again?
I would raise it in a different way. If it was going to come up, it should have a way to engage people in conversation across the state about the issue and about how it would be implemented. You know, many parents leave their kids at school super early as it is because they don't have flexibility in their jobs. This has to be done in a thoughtful way.
LA Unified and the teachers union are in the process of a very heated negotiation process, and teachers have already voted for a possible strike. If teachers walk off the job, what's the role of the state superintendent at that point?
Well, there isn't a formal role as it relates to that district, but obviously the state superintendent should be using relationships to try and prevent the strike at all costs. Now, whenever a strike level is reached, and listen, you know, I'm the labor chair. I support workers' right to strike when they feel that they're not being heard. But at the end of the day, we have to do all that we can to avert a strike because no one benefits, not the workers, not the students. And so I would use my relationships to try and find a solution that makes a strike a last resort that can be averted.
We're talking to Tony Thurman. He's running for state superintendent of public instruction. All right, let's get back to resources for a second. The local control funding formula was created in an effort to direct more money to the most at-risk students. Do you think that the current superintendent, Tom Torlakson, was wrong or right to allow that money to be used on teachers' raises?
I'll just say that I would make a different ruling. Those dollars should be used to support the students that they were intended to serve. And I would just say that I co-authored legislation this year that actually gives $300 million more dollars to support students through the local control funding formula who've been identified as the lowest performing students in our state. I would say this, though. I think part of the challenge is the local control funding formula, as helpful as it has been, it only raises what we spend on students to about 2008 funding levels when we were in a recession. I think the feedback here for us, what they're saying is, we're not funding education at the level that it needs to. The way to relieve that pressure is to provide more overall funding. And I'll, as superintendent, would be honored to lead a campaign for the ballot measure in 2020 that would change how Prop 13 taxes corporations so we can generate another $6 billion for K-12 education. You know, I think that's got to be our top priority.
I wanted to ask you about a donation that you received from the union that represents prison officers. This was after your opponent criticized how much we spend on prisons over school, and you've spoken about against actually what some call the school-to-prison pipelines. How do you feel about California spending as much as we do on incarceration versus education?
We spend way too much on incarceration. We've known forever it's cheaper to send a student to Harvard than it is to incarcerate them. You know, if I could just clarify a little, there is a Correctional Peace Officers Association that apparently has contributed into an independent expenditure committee to support my campaign.
Now, half a million bucks on campaign ads. So that's kind of sounds like they're spending it on you.
Well, candidates aren't allowed to get involved with any independent expenditure committee. Mm-hmm. The reality is no public official has done more to help close the school-to-prison pipeline than I have. It's unfortunate that I think people are trying to distort my record and using political arguments that are just really unfounded.
Now, the achievement gap in California, there's a clear gap there. What would you do to lift up academic performance for our Black and Latino students?
Well, I've already started. The governor signed a bill that I passed that provides language immersion and dual language instruction programs, especially for our youngest kids. The achievement gap starts before kindergarten. We've got to work with our families to know about reading to kids as soon as they're born. As superintendent, I will lead a campaign around early literacy and make sure we provide more training for our teachers. It's proven professional development for our teachers is the best way to close the achievement gap, coupled with early literacy and early education.
Why do you want this job?
You know, education saved my life. And when I think about the political legacy that I want to leave, I want to be able to provide those same opportunities for our kids. I want to spend the next 8 years helping to improve our schools. I believe that deeply, that we can change our schools. It is not an easy job. But because I've had success in the legislature by authoring legislation to change the direction of education, I'm banking that I can do that same thing.
Tony Thurman is a candidate for state superintendent of public instruction. Thank you very much for the time.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. So are you ready for Election Day? Get up to speed on what you need to know with KPCC's Voter Game Plan. Read up on the candidates and ballot measures. Find out about registration deadlines and ask us your questions. Head on over to elections.laist.com and we'll have more on the state superintendents there as well. Now, for the past 35 years, Saudi Arabia has had a ban on movie theaters. Now, that ended in April with the screening of Black Panther. It made Hollywood very happy because a brand new market opened up. But has the death of a journalist made Hollywood rethink doing business with Saudi Arabia? Find out when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now at Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Hollywood tries to distance itself from Saudi Arabia after the disappearance of a journalist, plus how a minor development in the Harvey Weinstein case could spell big trouble for the prosecution. Let's go on the lot.
God, I wish.
Stick your head out and yell.
You want a chocolate?
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Vanity Fair's Rebecca Keegan is here, as always, to be our guide through the Hollywood madness. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, A.
All right, so let's go back to April when we talk about all the business the industry was planning to do with a new Hollywood-friendly Saudi Arabia. Now, what kind of things were in the works back then?
Right. Well, when we talked about this in the spring, Mohammed bin Salman, the young crown prince of Saudi Arabia, had come to L.A., went to a big party at Rupert Murdoch's house in Bel Air. He was meeting with people like James Cameron and Bob Iger and Ari Emanuel, The Rock. And a lot of people were interested in doing business. Disney brought Black Panther, their movie, to Saudi Arabia for its first big screenings in that country in more than 30 years. I also went to Cannes in the spring and met with the Saudi delegation there, where they were sort of unrolling a new film tax incentive designed to get people to come shoot in the country. So there was a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm around this huge marketplace in the Middle East potentially opening up.
Now, fast forward to the present. Things aren't looking as bright anymore. Tell us about what's been happening that's prompting Hollywood to maybe distance itself.
Right. Well, the disappearance of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi is shining a light on aspects of this regime, which I think people in Hollywood either may have been naive about or were looking the other way about because of the, you know, sort of dollar signs in their eyes. Certainly, this is not something that you would want to be in business in as a industry that focuses on freedom of expression, theoretically anyway, Hollywood, to do business in a country where that appears not to be a priority would be concerning.
Give us, though, some context on Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and his role in all this.
Well, he is the millennial prince. He's very young, and he has been, on the one hand, trying to make the case that he will be opening Saudi Arabia and in turn, much of the Middle East, away from a sort of Islamic fundamentalism toward a more sort of open spirit toward the West. He's really motivated by wanting to diversify the economy of Saudi Arabia, which had been so dependent on oil. Yeah. And obviously, if you're doing all sorts of other things, including things in the media business, there's other sources of money coming into the country. At the same time that he has sort of made the case for opening the country, he has internally jailed prominent Saudis who disagree with him and has become a controversial figure for people who are following the region closely.
And AMC, IMAX, they all had business deals in the works. Where do those things stand now?
Well, a lot of people, I think, are taking at least publicly a wait-and-see attitude. You know, one of the conversations that people had discussed was the possibility of Disney opening a theme park there. That is certainly something that we've not heard any progress on, and an incident like the disappearance of Khashoggi would seem to, if there was any consideration, would seem to shut something like that down.
The film credit thing is really interesting to me in that Hollywood's always looking for new places to film. Places that people don't already associate with something that already exists. So I wonder if things were in the works to shoot some films in Saudi Arabia that might all of a sudden now be off.
Right. I mean, one of the interesting things at Cannes, the Saudi delegation did this very impressive sort of performance of sorts where they gave us all brochures that were sort of lushly photographed of the locations, trying to make the case for people to shoot there. Some folks had, I know, projects in the works that we will now see what happens to those projects.
All right, let's move on to the ongoing Harvey Weinstein saga. You wrote about a seemingly minor development over the weekend, but it actually could actually spell big trouble. So tell us about that.
Right. Well, late last week, a judge threw out one of the six charges in the case against Weinstein. And it happened because prosecutors admitted that a lead detective in the case had made a grave error, which is that he had not passed along an interview that he did with a witness who would have been favorable to Weinstein.
Credibility. I mean, that's got to be paramount, right? Mm-hmm. In a case like this, especially when it comes to a lead detective, how could that affect this case going forward now?
Well, it's really important because the charge that was dropped pertains to a woman named Lucia Evans. By dropping the charge, it's not so much Evans's credibility that they're calling into question as it is the detective's. So to the extent that this detective is also responsible for the five other charges, that's important.
Wow. So this could tumble completely down then.
Well, it's possible.
I hate to even bring up that as a worst case scenario.
Well,
but
it's possible that it could imperil the whole indictment. I mean, attorneys I spoke to, both those who've worked for prosecution and on the defense, have expressed that this would be this is a major concern. It's not just, oh, there go one of the charges, they're moving ahead on the other five. If the person who helped the DA's office put together the case was keeping information from them, that's problematic. And it's especially interesting in New York, where you have a kind of fraught history between the DA and the NYPD. You may recall that a few years ago, the NYPD had wanted the DA to bring charges against Weinstein. This was before the New York Times and New Yorker stories about him, and the DA declined to prosecute. So there had historically been this tension between the NYPD and the DA over Weinstein, which may have led to a sort of breakdown in communication in this hugely important case.
Things could be changing, though, when it comes to prosecuting sexual assault cases dealing with Hollywood. I mean, that could change now, especially in the climate that we're in now.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's no question when you look at the guilty verdict in the Bill Cosby case that we saw a sort of key moment. One thing that I heard from attorneys who I spoke with is that you're more likely now, they believe, in the sort of post-Me Too era, to get juries that are open to convicting. These cases have always been incredibly hard to prosecute, but they may have gotten easier. And the Cosby case is one example where the defense attorney tried things that had worked in the past, which was to really call into question and shame the victim and some of her witnesses, and it didn't work.
All right, let's end on the box office, because there were high hopes. I mean, like, as high as it actually went in the voyage to the moon. That's how high the hopes were.
Whoa.
For First Man. I know. How about that?
That's high.
Now, it ran into some troubles this weekend. How did it do? How did First Man do with the Damien Chazelle movie?
Right. Well, so First Man made about $16.5 million domestically. As you say, I think they did have higher hopes for this at Universal. The movie cost about $60 million to make. It had pretty warm reviews from critics. It seems to be an awards movie being made by Damien Chazelle, who was, of course, won the directing Oscar for La La Land. It doesn't seem to have really landed with audiences. I think that was not meant to be a pun, but I guess it was. There's some real competition in the marketplace right now, with A Star Is Born continuing to hold on to a sort of adult audience, and also a lot of men who are going to see Venom, which the male audience is important for this movie.
Yeah, well, and Venom continues to kind of have its grip on the box office, right?
That's
it just
right.
Won't let go. A movie that a lot of people kind of didn't like.
Underestimated,
at least.
Yeah.
How about that? So all of a sudden it's taken away from First Man. Is this maybe new to the time we're living in? Because the movie itself has suffered through some kind of maybe some political partisan arguing.
Right. Well, an interesting thing that happened before First Man had even screened was a controversy over the inclusion of the planting of the American flag on the moon. There are, if you haven't seen it, there are a lot of American flags in this movie. There's no question it is portrayed as America's space team that got this done. But the sort of controversy that ensued over that may have kept away key members of the audience.
Isn't that where Stanley Kubrick told the actor to put it on the soundstage?
I thought it's in the script.
It's in the script. Vanity Fair's Rebecca Keegan joins us every Monday to talk about the business of Hollywood. Rebecca, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, that's going to do it for Take Two. Up next, Air Talk with Larry Mantle. Hey, Larry.
Hey, good morning, eh? Coming up, we'll talk with Susan Orlean, the wonderful writer. Her new book is on the Los Angeles Public Library, the devastating fire back in 1986. And we'll also talk about how the library gets some of the strangest patron questions you can imagine. And they keep a record over all the years of the most bizarre questions people have asked. We'll hear about that. Susan Orlean coming up in our second hour of Air Talk.
All right, it's Air Talk coming up at 10. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks, A.